my first reaction was calling him, and that guy was called Gusti, and I was like, Gusti, are you okay?
Yeah.
And he was speaking with a low voice and acting weird kind of thing. So like, okay, this is what people called a possession. And I start just saying to God, like, God, I don't know what to do in this position.
Yeah.
But I pray that your kingdom come to this place. I don't know. I don't understand demons. I don't understand those spiritual maps that sometimes people do in cities. I don't know anything about that.
I just
know that you're in control of the world and you're sovereign.
Exactly.
So I ask that your kingdom come in this apartment. And I start praying in the name of Jesus.
Hi guys, welcome back to Rural Mission. If you're joining us for the first time, great to have you with us. In this podcast, we want to take you on a journey into places and communities around the world where the good news of Jesus is not known. We want to show you what God is up to, how his kingdom is expanding and growing, even in the most unlikely places. I'm Matt, your host, and in this episode, I'll be chatting with Jose. He currently lives in Indonesia, a country that has more than 17,000 islands and around 230 million Muslims. We'll be discussing the importance of the church in the global south for the mission of God, some excellent Latino theologians, and some fascinating stories from Jose's first few years as a disciple maker in Southeast Asia. Well, today it's a great joy to have a brother in the studio from Latin America. I think you're going to be the second Latino I've had on the podcast. So welcome, Jose.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good. It's a joy that you're visiting the UK at the moment and you're here for a few weeks. So we're going to take this opportunity to hear your story. Tell us a bit about where you grew up and how you came to faith.
Well, I was born in a small country in Central America. I grew up there. Like, my parents, my grandparents, nobody ever thought about going to another continent or another country even. And so we didn't have like that like DNA of traveling even. We didn't do like trips to exotic places as well. We didn't. So
yeah,
I was typical in that sense.
Yeah. And was it a Christian family that you grew up in?
Yeah, Catholic. My mom decided to change from Catholic Church to Evangelical Church when I was 7. And my dad follows as well.
Okay. And did you start to follow Jesus through your teenage years, or was it later on that you came to faith?
Yeah, I came to faith when I was 19. Yeah, for some reason I didn't understand the gospel until I was 19. It was a small group I attended. It was this pastor, he was a theologian as well. He explained me the gospel, and he didn't separate the gospel from missions.
Ah, interesting.
For him, the gospel was a mission in itself, of God coming to earth.
Yeah.
It's from changing one culture to another.
Yeah.
So since I was 19, at the same time I came to faith, I start catching the idea of missions because the gospel is a mission in itself.
Ah, that's so good. Yes, that's right. This is all about God's mission, not our mission. Yeah, he came to seek and save the lost, and that's what we're about now. We're just continuing the heart of God, the mission of God. That's really interesting. And a good reminder for us in our churches, you know, just because our kids or our young people are growing up in church, they may not have ever had that opportunity to be invited to follow Jesus or to understand just the heart of the gospels. And then what happened next?
Yeah, after that, I was very keen going to the field. And since that moment, since that I came to faith in February 2013, maybe in March, I was already thinking about going to the field.
Wow. But what did that mean to you? I mean, this idea of going overseas, did you know about unreached peoples early on?
Yeah, I didn't know before that. I didn't know. I was with this universalist idea about everybody will get saved somehow. Like every religion worships the same God, different shapes, kind of thing. Quite normal, right?
Growing up in church and not thinking about it much.
No, not thinking about it at all. And from the preachings, they didn't challenge us to think about that as well. In the church I grew up.
Yeah.
So it was until this small group that I was challenged. And I was like, yeah, well, if salvation is through Christ and there are like people not hearing the gospel, like 2 + 2 = 4 kind of thing.
We have to do something about this. Yeah, it's not just for me and my neighbors.
Yeah, actually, after that, from that small group, I came back to my church and I wanted to leave my church because I felt cheated. I felt cheated because nobody told me before.
Right.
Yeah. About the priority of God's missions today.
Interesting.
This church never, yeah. not even once, preach about that.
Mm.
So I came to my pastor and I said, like, why there's no missions ministry around here? And he told me, like, well, nobody have been interested. Do you want to start missions ministry with someone else?
Uh-huh.
And it was like, oh, and I was 20 and I was 19 at the time, without just coming to faith, without any experience about anything. So it all started like that.
Yeah. And when you say missions ministry, were they involved with local mission, but just not thinking at all beyond?
Yeah, it is interesting because I was new in faith. And I didn't know what missions was. For me at the time, missions was transcultural to the unreached, because that was this small group pastor teached me about what's missions. For me, missions was always the unreached.
Yeah.
Everything else was in missions at the time.
Yeah, I see.
I was really like extreme
because
it's like I told you, I felt cheated. And
you'd seen a gap and they hadn't talked about that key and core aspect of missions, perhaps. And so you felt, well, I've got to be all about this because nobody's talking about it. And then you're saying that as you developed and grew in your faith and understanding of scripture, you realized that, okay, yeah, missions does involve more things.
Mm-mm.
And this is one major element.
Yeah, yeah. But at a time, it's like missions are rich. Everything else is not missions. That's not important kind of thing, right?
It's, okay.
I was growing up in that idea, which years later, I just balanced.
Yeah.
Okay, what's God's mission? That's why I have like the question until today. Every year I do is, what is God's mission? What it looks like in this context, in this culture, in the world today, what is God's mission?
Right.
Because in each era, God's missions can look different.
Yeah.
The principle is the same, the theological aspects are the same, but the shape of the mission is very different.
Yeah, and that's true in different places and contexts in the world, but it's also true in our lives, isn't it? Lord, what's my role in your grand mission? Now, because we have different seasons, you know, in this season of my life, Lord, what do you want me to do? What's my role in your purposes? Yeah,
yeah,
great, great questions. Yeah. Okay, so you're still 19, your church leader saying, fine, you do something about mission or global mission. What happened?
Well, I did what everyone which is new in missions does, and it's going to Joshua Project. And
yes, a great website. Joshua Project, is it .net?
.net, yeah.
We'll put that in the show notes to make sure.
Yeah, it's like where is the most enriched people group and the most dangerous people group kind of thing, right? I was very energetic about the idea, and it was like, send me... And I don't care, I'm gonna die, like, right away I come to that place, but I have to go there, right?
Yeah.
Just like this energetic idea. I will do whatever it takes to go there. Just only go and pray there and try to communicate the gospel kind of thing, right? I was just very keen about going.
Yeah, that's right. I think when you do sense an aspect of God, it does become all-important and all-consuming, or a call from God, it becomes everything, and... Yeah, that's natural to want to respond fast to that and use that energy for his glory. But then, of course, you have to think, okay, how does this actually work in practice? How do I do this?
Yeah.
Even if the call is good.
Yeah. Hmm. One of the things that motivated me is that at the time, still 19 years old, I had this mentor from Frontiers.
Ah.
Yeah. And he mentored me. So we started attending a Bible study group. And... We must realize that at the time, I've never have shared the gospel with anybody.
Even in your local life. Context.
Because I was just recent coming to faith.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go to the unreached. And this mentor from the organization, every week we study a passage, Bible discovery group, like reading the passage and just asking questions to the passage. And what are we going to do this next week and with whom I'm going to share with.
Okay, so he got you, practicing sharing in your own context, so that you'd be preparing in disciple making and discipleship when you go overseas.
Yeah, and he showed me everything he knew at the time. He shared me all the context. When there was an activity about missions, he will invite me. He will like really mentor me and modeling me at the time.
Wow.
So that was very key because I just catched the DNA. Yeah, enriched people groups, priority, and I have to go there no matter what. And I have this conviction that the church have to send missionaries, and that's what got away, because first no missions agency wants to send someone without a church.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The church leadership have to say, yes, we trust this guy, we will get behind this guy or this lady, and we'll we want to pray for them, we want to support them, we want to bless them financially, so that it's our mission. I mean, first it's God's mission, then it's our mission as the church in another country, and thirdly it's your personal, you know, calling, I think.
Yeah, and then we start with this missions ministry when it was a transcultural missions ministry. It was a misunderstanding, because I was saying all the time, let's do missions, and the pastor was saying like, okay, let's go to the streets.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, like the real missions, because at the time I couldn't communicate what I was thinking about transcultural and
cross-cultural, transcultural. Yeah, you just didn't have that vocabulary.
I didn't have like the vocabulary, the basis, and everything. So it was a long process. Understanding that I had the responsibility to communicate properly for other people to understand what I was saying, especially because this Federation of Churches is not a denomination, but it's like a network of churches. The head pastor said like explicitly, transcultural missions are not effective. Mm-hmm. So this network of churches only plant churches in Latin America.
Oh, I see.
So from 20 churches at the time, my church was like the only one, or me pushing them, was the idea about sending a guy long term in an unreached people group.
Wow.
So it was.
Is that typical in your home country of other denominations, other churches? Do they have a sense that this is our commission, our great commission to go to the ends of the earth?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty normal in Latin America, especially because we're a receiving country. We are used to like see like foreigners all the time, especially Americans, because it's closer. And we were just used to it, like, and nobody really understood like why there were so many missionaries coming. And at a point that people say like, why just receiving more kind of thing?
I still ask the same question. Why do we keep sending people to Latin America? The church is stronger there than in the UK. Yeah. Surely there are other places we should go.
that's a sense when you don't know about missions and the areas of missions, right? Yeah. There were Americans coming for biblical training or theological training, teaching kind of thing. But like when you don't know anything about that, you're just like, why are so people coming here?
Exactly.
Like, what is all this, right?
And God's ways aren't our ways, and of course sometimes he will call someone from here to perhaps Kenya, where the church is very strong, but you know, he has a role for different people, and sometimes he'll send Kenyans to the UK to bring the gospel here, and we don't understand all God's ways, but overall we know there are needy areas of the world where nobody is going, and we must be sending people.
I think Latin American churches are used to like receiving but not sending.
Okay.
Latin America is definitely now have sending potential.
Yeah, huge.
If Latin America doesn't send, it's because they don't want.
Yeah.
They don't have that priority.
Interesting.
For sure.
Yeah, it's not a lack of resources. It's not a lack of people. The church is growing and thriving.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it in Frontiers, aren't we? So many sending bases now in Latin America over the last 10 years emerging, which is very exciting. So how, in your own personal story then, did you end up living in Indonesia?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was with this Frontiers mentor, and he told me the minimum requirement for you to go for a short-term trip is to do this course called Perspectives.
Yes, okay. Yeah, Perspectives on World Mission, a great course,
Yes, and it was, since day one, just like I was amazed. So the final project was create a strategy to reach an unreached people group, or an engaged people group, I think it was.
Wow.
And it was this thing about, let's go to the internet again. What is the most unreached people group?
Yeah.
But I came across with Indonesia. It's the most populated Muslim country in the world. And it's like, 2 + 2 = 4. They have 200 million Muslims in Indonesia.
Wow.
So I have to go there. I didn't ask a lot of questions. It was more logical. And I was doing some research, and there were two islands that caught my attention because Indonesia is archipelago.
Yeah, an archipelago. Archipelago. Yeah, huge number of islands. Is it what,
70,000
islands? How many islands?
17,000.
17,000
islands. But only 6,000 are populated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still, that's a huge number.
So there are five big islands there.
Okay.
Sumatra and Sulawesi. Mm-hmm. And I was between those two. And it starts growing my focus in Indonesia since I was, 20 already, 20 years old. And I asked my pastor from this church, would you send me kind of thing?
Yeah.
And they was like, yeah, let's go for it. My pastor didn't say no to anything.
Okay.
He didn't want conflicts kind of thing.
Oh, wow. That's useful.
Yeah. And then just like we launched this, I call it exploration trip because I don't know why. I was so convinced that I was going to live long-term in Indonesia, even though I didn't been there before.
Yeah. You'd never seen it, never set foot on the land, but you just knew somehow.
Yeah. It was because this logical idea of they have less, so let's go kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So you did a short-term trip when you were 21. What was that like, just landing in Sumatra, was it?
Yeah. It was in Java. In the island, Java Island, because there was a Frontiers team in Java. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I knew so little about Indonesia. And it was very eye-opening because the situation is quite different, as I imagine. There's this city, an unreached people group, millions of people, one unreached people group. Mm. But there were a lot of churches in the city. Mm-hmm. So I was asking like, okay, so why I am here?
yeah.
Kind of thing, right? And I start discovering that those churches belongs to other ethnic groups in Indonesia, but they're already Christians. Okay. And they were not doing a lot about reaching the people group of that city, that unreached people group.
Yeah, I think it's quite common, isn't it, in Southeast Asia, several countries where there are some growing, thriving churches, but very much, one particular ethnic group, one background, many would be Chinese background believers, and they have no heart for Muslim peoples.
Yeah. There's another ethnic group in Indonesia that is Christian majority, and it's called Batak, and it's in North Sumatra.
Okay.
The story of this ethnic group is that there were two American missionaries, and they went, and the Batak were cannibals. So they ate those two missionaries.
Wow.
That's the story.
Wow.
Then this guy called Nomensen from Germany, missionary, came to the Batak, and all the ethnic group came to faith.
Wow.
So that's the story of this only ethnic group in Sumatra that is Christian.
And
so,
is that probably 100 years ago, 200 years ago or something?
Yeah. So the thing is that now the people group is Christian, and they have churches all over Indonesia because they are famous because they do business all around Indonesia.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of Batak churches and Chinese churches.
Mm.
And when I realized that those churches belongs to one specific ethnic group, I will say like, okay, so the question is, why are they not doing any efforts to reach their community?
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge in Indonesia, actually.
Yeah.
There are islands. There is another team from Frontiers. They're reaching an island that have zero churches. There are cases like that.
Yeah.
But the majority of Indonesia is like, there are churches from this ethnic group.
Yes.
In an unreached city. It's really curious seeing that.
So in one city, you can have 500,000 people, you know, who have no clue about the gospel, and nobody who from their ethnic background would be sharing the gospel with them.
Yeah, there are some aspects that I understand. The first one is that Christians are bullied in high school, since they were kids.
Okay.
Maybe they were playing with Muslim friends and people say, oh, you eat pork, or your parents drink alcohol, or your kind of thing, right?
Yeah, because they're the minority and they're not well understood, or they're just different.
Yeah, and I can understand that some Christians in Indonesia can have this trauma like, if I share with this one, I will go back to my childhood.
Yeah, yeah,
they will
that's true.
Mock.
And same in Pakistan where I was, that there is a small church, 3%, 4% of the whole country. So the Christians are a very small percentage. They're the lowest caste. They're the poorest of all Pakistani people because they came from the old Hindu lowest castes. And so, yeah, they feel very scared of the Muslim community generally, and blasphemy laws, all sorts of reasons why they're a bit scared to share their faith.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like when the economic crisis in 1998 was happening in Indonesia, a lot of Indonesians blamed the Chinese.
Oh.
So they were and more in detention, and there was a massacre. Like,
oh, really?
They were killing Chinese,
oh,
kind of
no.
thing. Mostly in Jakarta, but in other cities in Indonesia. Going to the stores, break into the stores and kill some of them. So there was this division between the Chinese and Indonesians. It was even more pronounced.
Yeah.
And in religion terms,
yeah,
you can understand a little bit like that. It was a tragedy occurred in an economic crisis in Indonesia.
I
so
see.
You can understand.
Yeah. It's like the Jews and the Samaritans, isn't it? You know, even though they're your neighbors, they've become over history and time through politics, through economics, and then theological differences, there becomes this animosity, this enmity. And why would I share the gospel with them? It's like Jonah feeling called to the Ninevites even.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to go and share the gospel with them. Yeah. They're the enemy.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit hard, and I understand, especially for the Indonesian listeners, if there are some Indonesian listening to this podcast, it is a little bit harsh. I'm just telling this like very natural way, but it's just it is something in history. 1998 is like yesterday.
Yeah, it
25
is.
25 years
it's
ago.
Nothing.
It's nothing. So it's, I think... It's not about they not wanting to reach specifically. It's because, okay, we have to address this issue from the past and understand why I have to reach them. And
even if I want to, how do I do that without causing a riot or causing major problems? Yeah.
Yeah. There was a friend, he's Batak, and he was laughing. He is a missionary, local missionary, and he was sharing the gospel in like in 5 minutes kind of thing, right? And he ended his sentence like asking the person, do you want to receive Jesus Christ as your savior? And the guy responded like, oh, I have a friend that is Batak as well. So he didn't say like yes or no. He just like, oh, of course, you're Batak, you're Christian. Great. Like,
just
leave it there. Like,
Or maybe in his mind, why would I become Batak? I'm not Batak.
Yeah.
Just,
as well. So there's this separation. I've been in Indonesia 4 years. So there are more people that know that 4 years in the field is like just newly born, right?
Yeah.
There are like people having 25 years of experience.
Yes.
I understand that. So
yeah.
I'm just watching a little bit.
Yeah.
And
still figuring things out.
Observing.
Yeah. So did you find that when you did your short-term visit and even now, did you find that a lot of the Frontiers teams are working closely with the church, the Batak church or the Chinese background church, to try and encourage them to reach their Muslim friends?
Yeah, I think that's the way right now in Indonesia. Partnering with locals
is
so crucial, because if we talk about indigenous movements that emerge from that ethnic group, we have to talk about sending movements in Indonesia, meaning Indonesians catching the vision and Indonesians sharing with Indonesians the vision.
That's right.
That's an indigenous movement.
Yes.
If not, that will be a foreign
movement,
right?
Yeah, there is a role for the foreigner, but it's often behind the scenes, coming alongside, just lighting a little fire, you know, that will just spark off and catalyze a movement.
Yeah. There's churches in Indonesia I've seen that they use a lot of foreign material. I mean, when we're talking about missions, we are talking about the same figures like William Carey, Hudson Taylor. It's kind of the same training in Indonesia when we talk about missions. But what is interesting, I came across the missions course in Indonesia, and they were talking about missionary movements that occurred in Indonesia since 100 years ago. So obviously they are already creating local stuff. It's not always foreigner stuff. Okay. It's quite sad, right? Just following like a guideline of foreign kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And sadly, that is often the way, whether it's in church and with church theology and church practice or missions. Yeah, the more local it can be, local owned, local driven, local language and culture, then it's going to be so much better.
Yeah. So
let's get back to your story. Yeah. You did the short-term trip, and did that just make you feel, yes, 100%. I thought it was Indonesia. Now I know it's Indonesia.
Yeah. I went 2 months to Indonesia, 1 month to Malaysia, 2 months going back to Indonesia, and a little bit of time in Thailand.
Oh, okay. Mm.
But mostly Indonesia. I went back to Latin America. I start doing these events, telling like people, the supporters, churches and everything.
Yes.
What was Indonesia looks like. And it took me 4 years to go back again to Indonesia.
Okay. Yeah.
Because surprisingly, my church was doubting a little bit more about sending me back.
Yeah.
For a long term.
Okay.
When we're talking in Latin America about sending, pastors and churches will think about monthly payment.
Okay. Or they're worried salary. About that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think in the South Global,
yes,
people can have the vision of the mission of God, but they will say like, no, financial, we are not okay financially.
Okay.
And I think we have to change that mindset, because there's always money, money for everything.
That's right. Yeah.
And there was one pastor in my church that was stopping that process, me going out again.
Okay.
For some reasons I don't know until now, this pastor got fired. And then 1 year later, I was in the field again.
Okay. Yeah. So what did you do? What else did you do in those 4 years? Did you get some theological training during those years?
Yeah, I came back from Indonesia. I felt that I had addressed theological issues that I had. And so I started the seminary at the same time.
Okay.
I came back.
Now, we're going to come back to that, because I know right now you're doing a master's. So I want to bring the listeners up to speed with where you are now and what your life is like now out there in Indonesia. Yeah, I really want to hear about some of the Latin American theologians that, you know, some are famous, René Padilla, Samuel Escobar, that I've come across, but many of us won't know, you know, the context there. So we'll come back to that later on. Let's just fast forward at this point to going out long term. Yeah. By this time, your church is behind you.
Yeah.
Or the network of churches, hopefully, are behind you. And off you go. You're joining a team in Sumatra. Who is out there? Were you joining a healthy team of 6 people, 8 people? What did it look like on the ground?
So 2019, I was 26 year old. And finally, my church said, we're going to send you. So I start doing all the process. Came to Indonesia, to my city in Sumatra. And there was 3 families. And so I joined them, 2 Latin families and 1 American family that they were there since 2014. And it was challenging because... Well, I was the only single in the team. So, different dynamic. But I was with the same energy. So, it's just like, I will do my thing.
Yeah. Did you live on your own, or did you live with one of the families?
I live by my own. And I think it's a little bit of who I am, right? It's just like I feel better living by myself and having this time with people and having my times by myself.
Yeah.
To recharge kind of thing.
And... what are some of the major cultural differences between your home and Indonesia? Like, are they similar climate, for example? Describe what it was like to just be there.
Yeah, I think it's Indonesia, it's quite similar in some aspects. Both are tropical countries. So I wasn't surprised about the heat or the rainy season that it rains every. Second thing, we both are indirect cultures. Other people in the team, it was like, why is she or he saying that if he or she didn't mean it? And I was like, oh, I can understand that.
Okay.
Because I do that all the time.
Interesting. Same with us as Brits.
Yeah.
We're quite indirect. Yeah,
I just discovered that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And you actually, you don't, physically, you don't stand out. Dark eyes, dark hair. You're not sort of white and blonde hair and completely different walking down the street. You know, I don't suppose, I mean, maybe they know you're foreign, but it's not completely different.
Yeah, they think that I'm from, there were two countries. They said like I was from Pakistan.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been Pakistan or Turkey.
Okay.
There were a couple of Turkish guys that starts speaking with me in Turkish, and I was like, well, it's really cool, but I don't understand.
Nice.
Yeah. Typical Southeast Asian city, messy, unplanned, a lot of motorbikes everywhere, very hot.
Noisy,
pollution, people, great, very friendly, very easy to make friends right away. They appreciate foreigners. So you just like, you start speaking with somebody, you can ask their number. Next day, you're drinking a coffee, staying at their house, or they are staying at your house.
Yeah.
Very easy.
That's cool.
To share. And very easy to start talking about religious things as well. So it's that's a very positive thing I found in Indonesia, because it's not like taboo talking about religion. It's just like, and it's our daily life, where there's a mosque there, there's a church there. I have some Muslim friends would say like, I have Christian friends, they eat pork in Christmas. I know what is Christianity, eating pork, drinking beer in Christmas. That's Christianity kind of thing, right? I know what's Christianity, obviously.
Okay, and so lots of misunderstandings, but an openness to talk about it.
Yeah.
I want to mention an event we've got coming up in the UK on Saturday, the 18th of November. It's our Frontiers Neighbours and Nations Day conference in Oxford, where we'll be gathering to worship, to pray, and to connect with you, our friends and supporters. There'll be seminars to encourage and equip you, time for you to meet workers from the field and those preparing to go, a free lunch, and even a live Raw Mission podcast where you can be in the audience. Reserve your place on our website or email booking@frontiers.org.uk.
Yeah. Actually, in every Christmas, I think only 1 year I didn't do that. I invite my friends to my apartment. I didn't decorate anything because obviously that's not Christmas decorating, right? Mm-hmm. And in a Muslim country, that wouldn't be beneficial for our work there. So one of my friends came to my apartment and he was like very excited. And he asked me like, so where's the beer? And he was like very afraid of like eating something that had pork in it or non-halal kind of thing, right? And I asked them, a group of people, I think that the first Christmas I did like that. The second one, there were like 8 of them, all Muslims. Mm. 6 guys, 2 women. And I asked them, do you really know what's Christmas about? Mm. And they was like, not really. And I start with the Injil, with the New Testament in Indonesian. I start reading. Reading this, and what do you think about that? And I said to him, like, you know, that story is in the Quran as well. You know, the story of Isa al-Masih in the Quran.
Yeah.
And we started talking. It was like small circle. I have my apartment is very small.
Yeah.
But I have like a small living room, and we were just talking for 1 hour or 2. Like, do you know that? And
cool.
And one of them said, I know that. And another one, you see, there was like this image came to my mind right now. That is, we were speaking. One is just like with this serious face, kind of angry a little bit. Mm. Other one, very open, very keen to ask more questions. Another one in my left will start taking the New Testament and reading it directly, kind
on
of thing.
His own.
So I think
cool.
That's Indonesia.
Yeah. Okay.
That's Indonesia.
What interests me about that story as well that you just shared is that there were 2 ladies there.
Yeah.
That would never happen in Pakistan, I don't think. Rarely, anyway. But were they married couples that came together then?
No, actually, that's something characteristic in Indonesia. You can be friends with women.
Okay.
Not very close.
Sure.
But you can have...
Conversations
on the street. And even if there's... Usually, groups of friends have men and women.
Okay.
And we together one table and I've seen in television this old lady punching a military guy, young guy, kind of thing. And it was like, what is this? And it was like, I start to comprehend that Indonesia is not like the typical Middle Eastern country in those terms.
With segregation.
Yeah, with segregation. No, it's like one table, men and women, we share, we laugh together.
Yeah.
Women mocking guys, guys mocking women kind of thing. It's very natural kind of from the context I came from, which I have like female friends, male friends, and then we just in one group, you just go out and hang out.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I remember my wife saying, because she was in Aceh province, Indonesia, when we first met, she was working there, and she said, yeah, we ride motorbikes around the village. I was thinking, what? That would never happen in Pakistan, sorry. Yeah. But yeah, every Muslim society is a little bit different.
Yeah.
And they have different cultural rules, and
totally.
You just have to learn them when you get there. Were you learning language immediately?
Yeah. For day one, what I learned before coming to Indonesia, even the first time, is just learning the language. That was a non-negotiable.
Yes.
I won't speak in English because at that time my English wasn't good as well.
Okay.
So it's just like, it's like I don't know any English. And Indonesians, usually they don't speak in English because they don't need it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it was a Dutch colony.
A Dutch colony, 350 years Dutch colony kind of thing.
So that's an advantage to you, actually.
Yeah.
They just go straight to Indonesian. No one's going to speak Spanish with you.
And my strategy to learn the language was spend the most amount of time with people and I will learn the language.
Yes, exactly.
Every day, if you, even you're tired, if you're, if I believe that I reached my limit that day, be there passively speaking, half sleep kind of thing, because you're here, your ear is working.
Yes, you're still soaking it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that's true. I remember the same thing. In the first year, sometimes I would fall asleep in the corner. I was so tired and my tongue was trying to make all these sounds. And eventually you're just trying to follow the conversation. You just give up and just fall asleep in the corner. But it's good. You're just hanging out. You're being there. You're soaking up the atmosphere.
Yeah. And Indonesians will do that. They were just in a group. Oh, I'm sleeping, and then just like go sleep.
Did they stay up late?
Yeah, put their like arm as a pillow, and then we just continue talking with all this noise. It doesn't matter.
Good.
So it's part of being part of the culture. And I think that language learning for me, and I will say this for the majority of people learning the language, is not about how intelligent you are. Learning the language is more an emotional process. How you manage frustration during the language learning. It's not about the IQ. It's about how you face those times when you are in a group of people and 10 people around you are laughing at you because of your pronunciation.
Yes.
How you manage that.
Yes.
And do you push or you hide?
Can you laugh with them? Can you laugh at yourself? Can you persevere?
Yeah.
Can you be a fool for Christ?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No, that's true. Yeah. It's annoying at first. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing.
But then you push through and you get better. And then people are more encouraging as you get better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us some stories of some of your friends, some of the people you've interacted with that you're seeing maybe God's at work in this person. Yeah. Give us some anecdotes.
Yeah. It was very surprising. The first year, it was really focused language. I was telling people about Christ because I didn't want them to know me as an atheist or somebody that doesn't care about religion.
Yes.
Since day one, I was just carrying my Bible, putting my Bible there. They come to my apartment, put visible the Indonesian one. Some of them open the Bible. What is this? What do you believe? Are you a Christian? They will ask me. And I start conversation like that. Some of them open the Bible, read a little bit. Some of them show me like YouTube apologetics, Muslim apologetics.
Dr. Zaki Naik, check this out. Yeah, okay.
That was the one he showed me that time. But when I was 1 year there, I have this local friend, Indonesian, Batak, but really focused in missions. Really rare. Very focused, very keen to reach that unreached people group in that city. And he called me once and he told me, there's someone that wants to know a little bit more about Jesus. Come here tonight at 7 and he will come here and we'll share with him. 1 year and 2 months been there. And I came to his house. He was there and my friend was there. So the three of us were there. And we were with my language and, well, with my friend do the majority of speaking, obviously. And I was trying to
chip in a bit.
Yeah, to explain him a little bit as well. And my friend asked me, do you want to do a Bible study about baptism next week so we can see if we can baptize him?
Wow.
So I made the Bible study and I prepared 3 pages about what was the meaning of baptism, because they don't have an idea of what that concept is. It's rare for them, right? We made the Bible study. He was saying, okay, yeah, I want to get baptized. So we baptized him in the bathroom of my friend. And we started discipling him for a year every week. Yeah. And we asked him, we're like, why did you was attracted to know about Christ? And it was a funny kind of weird story, because he had some financial problems, financial issues, and he was really frustrated. And he say once, he was asking the Lord for guidance, and or God for guidance, and he said hallelujah kind of thing, because it was like the thing that he heard from the Christians. And after that, he felt peace in his heart kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I won't question that. For me, it's kind of funny.
That's weird, what started strange. Him on the journey.
And started him with a journey. He had some Christian friends and a friend, a family of him, and starts playing a little bit. But he didn't live in Palembang, in my city. And then contact my friend. So we just came together, and that was it. It was like, it was pretty strange, because 1 year there, I didn't expect that. And I was sharing with more people. They wouldn't like hear me. And this was this guy that said, hallelujah, and felt peace, and now he was baptized.
That's so cool.
And I don't know.
How did it go in terms of, did he feel any confidence to share what he was learning with other Muslims?
Yeah, that was a requirement.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, in every Bible study. Mm. Even he started sharing a lot.
Mm.
And he went to the hospitals, and he had a heart for the sick kind of thing, because he went to the hospitals and prayed for the patients.
Oh.
He was telling people, it doesn't matter if I pray in the name of Isa al-Masih, of Jesus. And people say, yeah, in the hospital and kind of thing. Never, not that we know, a miracle happened with that process with him, like sharing, praying, sharing the gospel with friends, with his wife. That before coming here, I heard that his wife was baptized like 1 month ago from now.
Really?
One month ago, kind of
amazing
thing. And he was three years already
in the faith. Wow.
And because he's married, so he started that process with my friend and his wife. So I just thought, like,
let them do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, brilliant. Any other little stories that help us get an idea of your life out there with locals?
There's another story. We, at the same time this was happening, there was this guy, Agus, and he had a dream of a cross, a shiny cross. He knew at the time that this cross was the Christian's cross, because he went to Korea to work there.
Okay.
There was a Korean church that have space for people that work there illegally. And they were like, they were having like this the center for people that are Indonesians that were working in Korea. He had services every Sunday, but he never understood what was that about. And 20 years later, he had this dream in my city of a cross, shiny cross, and he starts looking for a church. He said that he was in front of a church and he was very scared to go in, because he thought that Christians wouldn't accept Muslims. Maybe I will go like expelled from this church kind of thing.
They might turf him out.
Yeah,
I think he's a spy or something. Yeah, happens in Pakistan.
So he contacted another friend, and this another friend was a friend of my leader. So my leader was start discipling him. And so was very cool. But this guy took 1 year and a half to get baptized, Agus. And it was as simple as that. He recognized that the cross of the dream was the cross of the Christians in Korea. Now he wants to learn about the Bible and Jesus kind of thing. So I say, like, all the time when people ask me, what do you expect being there? And I would say, like, for God to do more miracles.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes, like, we try so hard to convince people and trying to look for the better strategy. Mm. And those two stories are representative, like, to come to the conclusion that it's God's work. We are there to disciple. Yes. We are there to baptize. Yes. But we are working together with God.
Yeah, he's usually started the story ahead of us.
Yeah.
Before we came, something's happening.
Even 20 years ago.
Yeah, and we're available so that if someone is ready, the Lord can bring them to us to move them forwards in the faith journey.
Yeah. What are the ethnic groups where the gospel is less accessible? That is the question for me.
That's right.
And how can we be available for them?
That's right.
For the moment they want to hear we actively preach in the gospel in those less accessible places in the world.
Yeah.
I think that's a little bit of what I'm thinking the last year.
That's so key. That's right. I often say the same. What if someone has a dream? Or even less miraculous, they come across something on TV in the Middle East. Where do they go? Even if an interest is sparked, or they're suddenly fascinated by Jesus because they had a dream. Well, who do they talk to? Who can disciple them? I mean, you have to have people on the ground who can speak their language, who they can find.
Yeah.
And of course, if it's local believers, great. But sometimes there just are no local believers around.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is great. I love hearing the stories. Any more like that?
Yeah, it was another one was pretty rare as well. I live in a two-story apartment, 10 apartments. Mm-hmm. I live in the second floor, 9th apartment.
Mm.
That guy from that number 10, he was a friend of mine. Mm. And we shared a lot, Muslim as well. And once I was playing basketball, I have my cell phone there. I didn't know he was calling me. Like, when I pick up my phone, I have like 5 missed calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, something happened in my apartment maybe, right? Or he needs help kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I texted him and she's like, oh, let me know when you're here. So I came back to my apartment. Why is he not outside of his apartment waiting for me kind of thing?
Mm.
And when I ask him again, I knock his door and it was like there was the window have a curtain, but I could see like through the window. Mm. And I saw him like running from his room to the door to open. And they told me like, there's a ghost there, kind of thing. And okay, so I thought like, what should I do? So I want them to be calm. So I go inside, like calm, like nothing happened. I was like, okay, what happened? And I asked him, oh, people were calling my name when I was taking a bath. I'd make a little joke just to release the tension a little bit. Mm. And I heard something in the back, someone moved something in the back kind of thing. Some weird stuff that happened in the apartment. And we were there talking, 1 a.m. We were talking just for them to be more calm. And they asked me, are you not afraid living by yourself all the time? And it was like, no, because I believe in Jesus. And I believe that if you are in Jesus, you have this peace that you wouldn't get it anywhere else. And I asked them, do you want me to pray in the name of Jesus for this not happen again? And we were sitting down in the apartment, in his apartment, and I started praying. And he passed out.
Oh.
Yeah. Like
he collapsed on the floor.
Yeah, and he crashed his head to the floor and was like, "Oh, okay, this is not normal." And because I'm not that spiritual or not that charismatic, I thought like this is a health issue.
Yeah. Well, it's possible.
My first reaction was calling him, and the guy was called Gusti, and I was like, "Gusti, are you okay?"
Yeah.
And he was speaking with a low voice and acting weird kind of thing. So like, okay, this is what people called a possession. I don't know what to know about.
Yeah, possession or some kind of evil spirit speaking right now through him.
Yeah. And then at the same time, there were people, some of his friends that he already called earlier arrived.
Mm.
And I start just saying to God, like, God, I don't know what to do in this position.
Yeah.
But I pray that your kingdom come to this place.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't understand demons. I don't understand those spiritual maps that sometimes people do in cities. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah,
just know that you're in control of the world and you're sovereign.
Exactly.
So I ask that your kingdom come in this apartment. Mm-hmm. And I start praying in the name of Jesus. I prayed in Indonesian. Yep. Because their friends came and their cousin was hearing. they were like looking like in the door like this outside the apartment. Like,
yeah, what's happening?
What's happening? Mm. And I'm seeing three heads like looking through the door. They didn't want to come in as well because they were afraid.
Interesting.
My friend just fell asleep.
Yeah, he fell asleep when you started praying for him.
And I just was praying for peace to him and for his cousin as well, and in Indonesian. And they all, the four of them, attend to an Islamic university.
Yep.
And the Islamic State University from the country. So after that, and after he fell asleep, we were talking about Jesus all the time. And they were saying, like, we can invite you to my university to talk about Jesus, kind of thing.
Wow.
It never happened, but it was like a good 1 hour talking about Jesus and what was
and
my testimony
over Satan
and
that's so good.
After that happened, this friend, the next day I asked him, how do you feel, what was that? And he told me, I make some black magic in Islamic school in the past, and this occurs me every 3 months.
Whoa.
Kind of thing. It wasn't weird for him to be like possessed.
And
I shared with him freely about Jesus always. And then he moved because he was too scared to live there.
Okay.
And that is not unusual in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Because it's very mystic culture. It's very about spirits, ghosts. Yeah. Even in the Christian world, people just like very afraid always.
Interesting.
Yeah. It just, it's a different context.
I think that's really important because we need to be prepared to some degree before we go to these places. You know, what is their worldview? What are their daily experiences? What are they worried about? Because if the needs that they have are based around the jinn or the evil spirits, then the good news to them is Jesus has power over Satan.
Mm.
We know Jesus has power over sin and death and all sorts of things. But if that's their major issue, we need to start thinking about, okay, how can we prepare well ourselves biblically and ministry-wise just to tackle some of these situations. It doesn't mean we become experts necessarily, but at least we must be aware this could happen.
Yeah.
And this is how to present the good news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. There was other encounters with friends, very close friends. They were called Jalu and Ilham. And with the first one, with Jalu, was very intense. Every time I met him, he was just opening the Bible together, kind of thing. Opening the Bible, discussing, and for a few times. And after one day, he just told me, like, I don't want to talk anymore about the Bible because my imam said that is corrupted. And that's it.
Interesting.
Because that's something in Indonesia that happens. The authority, obviously, they will respect more because they already have this revelation from God to be Muslims. I'm not a Muslim, so I haven't received this revelation of God. It's like Hidayah.
Yeah.
So you haven't heard that Hidayah. Yeah.
Advice or insight, information. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were two occasions with Jalu. Said it was very clear. My imam said the Bible is corrupted, so I don't want to discuss this anymore.
He didn't even want to listen to why the Bible might not be corrupted.
Oh, for sure, it's not. It wasn't the case because for them, the Quran just came from the sky, like word per word. Yeah. That's the word of Allah.
Yeah.
In what was revealed to Muhammad, word per word.
And you can't question that.
How I can explain how the Bible have textual variants? For a Muslim mind, talking about old manuscripts and texts, you don't even have the opportunity. They're all totally close to that.
Yeah.
And
whereas actually the revelation of the Quran is not so different.
Yeah.
And there were different manuscripts and there were different variants and still are different variants, but they just have never been taught that and can't ask those questions easily.
Because they won't believe you. Why they will believe me about the Khalifa Uthman burning all the Quran
that's right.
versions that he didn't like
in the 4th century?
Why I will believe that?
Why should I listen to that?
Why I will listen to that kind of thing, right?
No, that's a good point.
So it was with Jalu and with Ilham the next day. Say, like, my imam said this, I don't want to discuss it anymore. So that's a barrier. Like, that's why I always say, like, God have to do a miracle. It's the Holy Spirit, like, 100%. Because when I had this very interesting conversation that I just will think, like, he's going deeper and deeper. And the next day he will say, like, I don't want this anymore. I don't want to discuss this anymore. So prayer from the sending churches, from the home countries, it's vital. It's really a teamwork.
Yes.
The missionary is only being a representative of 1,000 people that from your sending home countries.
Yeah.
You're just like a representative.
Yeah.
For me, it's like that.
Yeah.
There's no other way.
That's really good. It is. It's a spiritual battle. And even if you think, oh, yeah, I could have said this or I could have said that, if their heart has stopped and closed, then doesn't matter what you say. Your arguments could be amazing.
Yeah.
But if the mind is shut or the spirit is shut,
yeah,
that's it. So prayer is the only thing that can soften hearts, communities even. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really good. Our time is running out, Jose. I do want to just ask you quickly about the MA. What are you studying right now? And I don't know, what encouragements can you give to a Western church audience, what the Latin American theologians are talking about, and what are you learning in that context?
Yeah, what I've been observing in Latin American context is there's this apparent dichotomy between the salvation of the souls, that phrase is very common, not only in Latin America, but I think in evangelical circles in general. Mm. But in Latin America, there's like, they're like contraries. The salvation of the souls or community development projects. Mm. They're just like apart.
Okay.
I've been observing that. I've been observing in Latin America that people think that the mission of the church starts in the Great Commission. Mm. Like just like a new idea from God.
Mm.
Great Commission, specifically Matthew version.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the second thing. There's a gap between the Old and New Testament.
Mm-hmm. So they don't see the heart of God for all nations throughout the scriptures.
And I start reading Latin American theologians, like you mentioned, René Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
René Padilla is one of the speakers in the Congress of Lausanne.
Yes.
In 1975, I think. And he exposed this idea of holistic mission or integral mission. That was, he said, like, there's no contradiction between the preaching of the gospel and the community development, social justice. It's like two wings of the plane.
Right.
He said something like, people will believe by hearing and they will believe by seeing what those people that preach, how they act, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was translating in my mind.
Sure.
But yeah, a little bit like that. Mm-hmm. And it's really inspiring because we're used to in Latin America to read about the North Global theologians. It's always those resources in English and everything. There's still a big number of Latin American theologians that the people until today, 1975, it's so far in history, it's like 50 years ago.
Mm.
And people right now in Latin America, they are not reading about Latin American theologians.
Mm.
And that's very,
it's a, like, shame.
It's a shame. And
yeah.
And they expose already about holistic mission very well done. Sometimes in Latin America, we don't appreciate things that come from our own culture. We are already looking for to the north kind of thing.
Right. And like you said, with the first, you talked about that place where they were cannibals and the first two missionaries that were killed and eaten, you know, hundreds of years ago. But they probably didn't come in speaking against cannibalism.
Yeah,
they come in speaking about the value of human life and who God is as the creator, and society starts to change and practices start to change because the mind is exposed to the truth about humanity and God.
Yeah. What's the core of their worldview? What's the core of their beliefs?
Yeah.
And how the gospel can transform that.
Mm. Yeah, Jose, this has been so good. I've really enjoyed learning more about a part of the world that I don't know that much about. And we just want to keep praying for more folks like you from the global church to go to places like Indonesia, where there are hundreds of millions of Muslims, many of whom will have no friend who's a follower of Jesus and nowhere to go to ask their questions. So thank you for sharing today, and God bless you as you, your life has some exciting things coming up, I know, in the next few weeks and months, and as you return to Indonesia, you know, we'll be praying for you.
Yeah, thank you. We need it, especially because... We usually doesn't have a clue what we're doing in the field sometimes, and sometimes God talk in this miraculous way, and we're just expecting that being accessible to people, transforming the city, the ethnic group, and you're just hoping that God do something, because that's partnering with God in this in this work.
It's His work.
Yeah, thank you for having
me. Thanks, brother. All right, God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for being with us today, guys. As we close, I want to offer you a gift. It's a beautiful invitation to come and join in with the mission of God, the transformational, life-giving gospel work that He has set before us. The Lord asks in Isaiah, "Who will go? Whom shall I send?" Could it be you? Might you be willing to lay it all down, to give up everything for the one who gave up everything for you? To join one of our teams in Central Asia, the Gulf, Africa, Asia, the Balkans, or the Caucasus? Or to support some of our work through prayer and finances. If your heart is stirred to respond, do reach out to us. You can contact me on matt@frontiers.org.uk or visit our website, frontiers.org.uk, or you can check out our social media platforms @frontiersuk. God bless, guys, and do join us next time for some more inspirational and challenging stories.